Hello there, it's Chris Sisson speaking, and welcome to Find, Tell, Share, the Storytellers Podcast. My business is Market Together. I'm a local marketing coach who specializes in using stories for marketing and business development in turbulent times. And here is my co-host.
Hi, I'm Gemma Rosenthal, and I'm a singer, songwriter, actor, and dancer choreographer. Poet, many creative things, and I support you in finding your voice and living your most creative self. And my business is called Creative Hearts. On this show, we talk about everything storytelling. This is our December broadcast and is a nod towards the season of family arguments over the dinner table, driving unwanted helpers out of the kitchen, enduring food stuff you don't normally eat for a good reason. Our theme is food. Later, we'll talk about how I actually launched my business in a kitchen. And then Chris will be talking about memories of grandparental cooking. But before all that,
I'm delighted to introduce our guest, Debbie Bridge, who is a voiceover actor. Having grown up in Canada and travelled a lot right from being a baby, Debbie has loved adventure and foreign places. This led her to end up starting her career, her performance career in the United Kingdom. She started out as an opera singer and then moved into straight acting, and that led easily to voiceover. Debbie has produced several shows and short films, performed all over the world on a small scale, and judged various competitions and taught several students. She believes strongly in the adage that a rising tide lifts all boats. So welcome, Debbie.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. It's nice to meet both of you.
So I've been wondering for a week or so now, Debbie, can you remember from childhood a favourite food that you always or almost always enjoyed?
Popcorn.
Popcorn.
In particular, the popcorn you get at the cinema. That was a favorite. It still is a favorite to this day. So yeah, popcorn has been a favorite food for me.
So is that sweet or salted or mixed?
Oh, no. Salted. Except I have just found the most amazing sweet popcorn. I don't normally like sweet popcorn, but this is a caramel maple syrup popcorn, and that is divine.
Right, yeah. Presumably you can't get that what do they call it nowadays? Cineworld. I was going to say ABC, and I thought that's gone. And then I was going to say Odeon, and I'm not sure if that's still there.
Yeah,
very struggling.
Yeah, I think Odeon's still there, isn't it?
Is it?
I think so. I think Odeon is still surviving.
Oh well, I wasn't expecting popcorn. That is definitely.
I know most people would say chocolate, but chocolate wasn't my favorite thing as a kid. I'm unusual that way.
Yes.
And what films would you be watching if you were having the popcorn?
Oh, animations, definitely animation films. Rom-coms. I love murder mystery type ones. Things like Raiders of the Lost Ark, sci-fi, love that stuff. Don't like horror, never liked horror. Don't understand why people need to scare themselves even more. I think life is scary enough. I don't need to go to pay to see fear. No, thank you.
That's mostly my favourites. I like animations and science fiction and great Doctor Who fan. And Doctor Who's not horrible at all. The latest episode where a giant worm comes out of somebody's mouth and might have been a bit on the horror track, but it's usually sort of knockabout fun. Yes. But I noticed you were an opera singer. So what were your parts?
I think one of the ones that really I enjoyed the most as a person who likes sci-fi is I got to do Opera Galactica. No, of course you wouldn't. It was specially written, and it was a mashup of a whole bunch of operatic styles, but it was set around the theme of Star Wars. So I was Princess Slayer. So that was probably my most favorite, fun, and really great role to do. And that was done at Edinburgh Fringe. So that was really cool. And that was, I was an understudy and I got to go on. So that was really cool.
That does sounds really fun.
It was good fun.
So I was hoping you were going to mention some parts that I'd heard of, and then I'd be able to
comment on them.
I'd work out what your voice is.
So that's always been a tricky one with me, because I'm very flexible physically, and so my voice is very flexible. So casting me has always been difficult. I've had people say I'm a mezzo, a soprano, a lyric, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I just like to sing what I like to sing. So I've done roles like Rosina in The Barber of Seville. In La Boheme, I was, what's her name now?
Musetta, is it?
Oh, maybe. Yes. Oh, yeah. Do I not look like a Musetta? Yes, I am Musetta. And in The Marriage of Figaro, I've done both the Count, I'm a countess and a Susanna, so there you go. I've even played Despina in Così fan tutte, which is considered more of a mezzo role. So, you know, it's just I'm all over the place.
Yeah, so you've not done the Queen of the Night then? No,
no, I'm not that voice type. I am. If I was a coloratura, I would be a mezzo coloratura, not
the Sarenzarola.
Yeah. I'm better at the. I could get the movement in the voice, but not the height.
I can remember in my younger days with a friend who was also an opera singer. We're both walking along the beach singing the Queen of the Night's aria.
Yes.
Yeah, but the bit that goes ah, it's the top something.
I think it's an E or an F or something
must be an exhausting role, because she must be on for about 5 minutes or two, and two massive long arias, and that's about it.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure. It's just color. I think when you're doing the work, it has its own energy, especially that kind of movement, because you can't stop ever. It's just keep going. You can't think. It has to be something that's so ingrained in you that you just fly. It literally flies out of the voice.
I feel like I need to research some opera now, because I'm feeling like, oh my God, like I just don't know much about opera, and I'm a singer, and I'm thinking, whoa, okay, need to brush up on my research. But it's a completely different field, I suppose, in terms of, because I did musical theatre, although we did obviously do some operatic kind of styles, like Phantom of the Opera or things like that. But yeah, it's kind of a genre I don't really know very well.
I didn't either.
I think there's an overlap between opera and musical theatre. I mean, there was something. I'm just trying to think of a few examples.
I would say things
Merry
like...
Merry Widow would be an example. Possibly Gilbert and Sullivan, although you could argue that they're opera.
They're actually considered operetta. It's a middle ground it's lighthearted opera, so it tends to be more of the comedy.
And then of
side.
Course we got Stephen Sondheim lyrics. I was thinking of West Side Story.
That's Bernstein.
Bernstein's the music.
Sondheim wrote
the lyrics.
Yes, he wrote.
And the
lyrics,
latest film is somebody else beginning with S, who's produced it. I can't remember his name.
Scorsese?
No. Anyway, it'll come back. But again, West Side Story. I've heard it sung by opera singers, and it sounded awful. The characters are kids, and when you get sort of mature opera singers, they don't sound like kids.
I sang Maria. I played Maria at college, and you did as well. Yay. It is a nice, it's a kind of, it does stretch your vocals in that kind of way because it is quite soprano. So yeah, that's probably the most, I don't know, the most operatic part I've had in a way.
Well, that's pretty much opera as it is, or could be. Yeah,
it's true. Yeah, it does kind of go in that way.
Opera's also about storytelling. And it's a way of telling stories. And one of the powers of opera is that you can get an insight into how everybody's feeling. And I mean, you mentioned Rossini, Barbara of Seville, but Rossini's very good at it. There's usually somewhere towards the end a scene where all the characters are on stage and they're all singing together ensemble, but they're all expressing different emotions. And he does that in several of his operas, usually in the middle of a thunderstorm. pretty much the same each time. That's the power of it. But I've got a little quiz, which you won't be able to answer any of them. It's just for me to show off my knowledge of opera. And basically, there's three questions. The answers are all women coming downstairs, and their names are either the name of the opera or quite close to the name of the opera in one instance. So the first one is a woman who comes downstairs washing her hands. That's an easy
one. Yeah, that's Macbeth.
That's, Lady Macbeth, yeah.
Lady Macbeth,
The second one is a woman who comes downstairs with a bloody dagger.
That's not Tosca, is it?
No.
Okay, no. Yeah, no, she doesn't come downstairs.
She doesn't stab anybody either.
She does. She kills...
She does. You're right, yeah.
Scorpio. So that's why I thought... Scorpio, yes. So that's why I was like... She does have a dagger.
She might have gone downstairs, but on stage coming downstairs.
Yeah, it's not known for that.
Well, this opera is known for that. In fact, the bloody dagger in this opera is pretty much all it's known for.
Oh, is that what it's called, the bloody dagger?
Well, no. It's called Lucia de Lammermoor.
Oh.
Donizetti.
That's why I haven't seen it.
Right. But that's quite well known. And then you won't know this one. She's coming downstairs with a glass of water.
That one's... No, I don't know that one.
That's Arabella by Richard Strauss. The water...
Haven't seen it.
It's right at the end. And the man she loves comes from another country. I'm not even quite sure what country it's set in. And in their country, when a man proposes, the woman accepts by giving him a glass of water.
That's why it's significant. Yes, gotcha.
Yeah, yes.
I need to get out more.
Can I just ask a good question? What got you into opera, and then because you do voiceover now, and you were an actor as well. So where did the opera come in? Was it in between the acting, or was it before the acting?
I still do acting, actually, but I did the singing in the opera first because I wanted to always be an actor. That was always part of what I wanted to do. But I ended up doing singing because I had a terrible, and sorry to you, teacher in grade 8, who was a terrible acting teacher, and I didn't like her class. So I went into singing. And then there they said, oh, you've got a talent. And I really wanted to do music theater. So that's where I was, trying to put myself into. And then I went to college, and they're like, well, no, you really should do opera. And so I did. Like you said, I had no background in it. I just went into it. I just thought it was fat people with horns on their head who screamed. I was so ignorant. So I did a degree to try and understand the art form. Because in Canada, you do more degrees than colleges. It's a slightly different system over there. And so I did that. And then I got a much better understanding of it and some training. I did most of my really good operatic training for the voice was here in the UK, actually, with the teachers here when I finished the degree and I came over. Yeah. So that's how I did it.
Do you think doing opera and acting kind of led you to the voice over stuff? What got you to where you are now?
Absolutely, definitely. Because I have a flexible voice, like I said, I'm flexible physically as well as vocally, so I can do all these weird sounds and it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
And you know, doing the acting work helps bring the characters out. So, which you already mentioned, of course, I did that in opera, but you can slide a bit with that. I'm not saying I wanted to. I was, a lot of the times I was hired as an opera singer because of the way I brought the characters across. And more nowadays, it's more and more important because we are such, we're used to having very good acting. So it used to be the tradition that in opera, you just kind of stood, and like in acting on stage, and you just held poses. Well, of course, that's now developed much. With the medium of TV and everything, we're so intimate that you can't just hold a pose like it was 200 years ago with candles. You know, you only had to hold the pose so people had an idea of what you were doing.
Yeah.
It's the interpretation of things has always been very important to me. And how they're brought across. And the music itself informs a lot of the character as well. So the composers were telling a lot about the state of the character by the way they wrote the music. It wasn't just in the words, it was in the sound you heard. You hear.
Yeah.
And I've already sort of hinted at this, but it's difficult, really difficult to watch an opera where the actors don't look like your image of the particularly La Bohème, you know, which is sort of students in a garret and they're all in the 40s.
Yeah, that is a drawback because you do need a relatively mature voice, in particular bass voices, because bass voices don't often mature until their 30s and 40s even. So it can take a long time. And so you've got this older male playing a 20-year-old, and it's like, okay, we'll just have to suspend belief.
Well, I think a character like Chouinard, I think Chouinard's bass, isn't it? The one who sings to the overcoat. He could get away with it, possibly, you know, because he's not a big character.
Yeah, he's a mature student.
But the two main men need to be, you know, at least in the 20s at most, I would have thought.
Looking young,
at least these days. I mean, if it's dark and it's all by candlelight, you wouldn't be able to see how old they were, I suppose.
Exactly. It was way more acceptable and not such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, the operatic voice does need time. So it's a good 10 years of training to get a voice to really be, you know, even like you're saying, the lighter voices tend to develop faster. The bigger and heavier voices, they tend to need more time to learn the control and the support that's required. So it really, it's also dependent on voice type and the training. You know, what kind of training? Because you can get very bad training out there these days. So you can head down the wrong path very quickly.
I was going to ask, what is the kind of, what did you learn from operatic training that maybe like I might not have learned in musical theatre training kind of thing? What's the difference? I mean, some of it, but just from your perspective.
That's a really good question, actually. I think the biggest thing I would say is the difference. For me is, I'm not sure there is a huge difference, I think, at the end of the day, but the hours of work might be slightly different. I think you can get away more with stuff in music theater, whereas in opera, it's so friggin' precise sometimes. They want such a precision, especially if you're not known. So if you're not a known singer, the flexibility within the role is not great. But then I've heard that about people in the West End. You almost literally, there's a big difference. In opera, you don't necessarily have to walk in and wear the same costume as the person who was in it before. Music theater, you have to look the part, you have to fit literally the size of costumes often. And you have to sound right because they're used to that sound. And so they're looking like you often see, like in The Phantom of the Opera, it's a big deal about what she looks like, and what her hair is always that long curly hair. and the costumes are always seem to be the same. So yeah, that's less restrictive in opera. Yeah. And there's this thing about opera that you can't move very much, which is a total lie. That's just really poor acting and training. Of course you can move as an opera singer. So that's something that people think you can't do in opera. Yes, you do need very good alignment of your spine, but that doesn't mean you can't move your arms and your legs. Yeah. So that's either very poor vocal technique, or, you know, they just have bought into a belief, or that you have to be large to be an opera singer and you can't exercise. That's also a complete lie. That's just poor diet. There's lots of weird beliefs out there. Like, you get actors who won't say Macbeth because, you know, that's you get lots of opera falsities out there. And I'm totally like, no, that's not true. I can do that. Here, I'll show you. See, you can do it. So if I can do it, that means you can do it. So I'm not an overweight opera singer with horns on my head. I am loud when I say, but you know, that part of it's true. So yeah, it needs a big instrument. I think the rib cages are larger for opera singers because we use a lot of the intercostal diaphragmatic breathing, whereas music theater, it can be slightly different. And how you use your mouth and your muscles in your mouth are probably the biggest differences between musical theater and opera.
And vibrato as well.
Yes. Although it depends on the musical theater. So if you're doing Oklahoma, you can get away with a lot more of that.
Yeah. I kind of want to hear you sing, but I don't want to put you on the spot.
It depends what you want. Do you want some opera? And will that distort the sound too much? Because it is quite loud.
We've no idea.
Oh, I see. Well,
give it a try and see what happens.
Here's my morning opera. Okay. Let me put my legs down here. Oh, mio bambino caro, mi piace bello, bello, vuoi andare in Porta Rossa a camperar l'anello. And then it goes on and on.
I think when the wiggly lines get to the top,
it peaks out. I'm not sure they're going to, you might want to edit that out.
It sounded great.
Yeah, it sounded amazing. I think, you know, our listeners will understand that the sounds, you know, we've not got the proper mics for the singing recording here. Which we should, because I'm singing as well sometimes on the podcast. But yeah, anyways, I think, is it probably time for the story?
Shall we just mention what that was?
It was. Oh, yes. It was O Mio Bambino Caro from Giannis Chichi by Puccini.
Ah, right, yes. I thought it was Puccini, but I didn't get any closer than that. okay, yes, well, shall we go into your story?
Yes, well, like I said, I have two stories because I feel like one's going to be too short. But yeah, here we go. My first story is a Christmas story, and I wrote it for the British Columbia Magazine, which is a very well-known magazine back home. So this is The Best BC Christmas. When I was a young lass, I was lucky enough to have friends with a cabin in Tulamine on Otter Lake near Princeton, British Columbia. I spent many summers and winters there swimming and building snowmen. I have fond memories of riding up at the top of my friend's truck camper as we drove along the Crow's Nest Highway. So you can imagine my excitement when my parents announced that we were going to spend Christmas at someone else's cabin on a new lake, which was also north of Princeton. Off we went with my grandmother and I sitting in the back seat of the car. Part of the excitement was the process of cutting down our own Christmas tree. Of course, we had to have the best tree, so my dad would stop if I hollered, "There's the perfect tree!" Usually, it was nowhere near the road. All the best trees are the furthest away. But we would get out of the car and I would give it an inspection. We did this several times before we found the perfect tree. It was getting dark, and my questions kept on coming. Who were the friends? Who let us use this place? Would my Otter Lake friends be there? What's at the end of this dirt road? And did my dad really know where he was going? There were no street lights, but the moon was full and clear, lighting up snow diamonds all around us. Eventually, after forever, we arrived at Missoula Lake. They had to say it a few times before I knew how to pronounce it. We had our proud tree attached to the car roof as we entered the sleepy, snowy, hollow wonderland of quiet. It was truly magical, just like the old cartoon film, Frosty the Snowman. I thought I had been transported to another land. It was love at first sight, and I wish I could stay there forever. We drove up a little hill while my parents had a small argument about which driveway to head in. They'd never been here before either, I guess, so it was not surprising. Finally, we pulled in, and the adventure continued. I saw this gorgeous red roof, acorn-shaped cabin. My favorite, as I love the little rooms you get at the top, which overlook the lounge, and my joy just glistened. It was like a winter dream come true. We'd arrived, but it was cold and late, and I couldn't wait to see which room was mine. Snag, my dad forgot the key, so he had to break the kitchen window. He managed to crawl in through the window and open the door. Then it happened, the most amazing part. As I walked into that cabin, it hit me. This wasn't a friend's cabin. This was ours. We finally got our own place to go to, like our friends at Tulamine. By the way, the tree we had cut down reached the ceiling of the upper floor where those little rooms were. But Mom had forgotten all the Christmas decorations except for the lights and some candies that needed to have their wrappers put on. So I went to work and managed to make paper rings, popcorn strings, paper snowflakes, and little decorations from what I could find. I eventually managed to fill that Goliath. Guess what? Those little rooms upstairs? One was mine, and I loved it. It was my favorite Christmas ever. So that's my little story about Christmas. seeing as we're talking a little bit about food today, those candies, my mom had this Austrian tradition that we would buy specialist candies and wrap them up in paper and eat them off the tree and eat chocolates off the tree. That was a very Austrian thing to do. So, yeah, it meant a lot to me as a kid. So I have my next story is weird. I was in the same area. Well, not the same area. I was in Kelowna, the Okanagan, which is a beautiful range in the interior of British Columbia. And I was doing the show West Side Story. I was playing Maria at the theater there. It was so much fun. And I was in this transition in life. I wasn't sure if I was going to move back to Canada or if I was going to, go back to the UK. And I just didn't know what to do. So I had this moment where I felt the need to go camping by myself and face what I called the inner bear. So I had this mortal fear of bears growing up in Canada. And so I did it. I went to a park after the show had finished. It was all done. It was a weekend. It was closing of the season, all that sort of stuff. And I put my tent out the night before. It was bucketing, absolutely bucketing rain. And I had this huge fire. And I'm sitting there with this massive umbrella, this huge fire, just going, I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know what to do. And then the ranger at the campground came in, and he was an Indigenous person from Canada. And he sat down next to me and says, I'm not sure you're going to have enough logs. Are you sure you're going to have enough logs? Because I was just burning so much. And I said, I'd probably be fine. But anyway, he was very kind. And he sat down and he talked to me. And we had this conversation about bears. And he mentioned, he says, oh, you need to face your inner bear. This is what this is really about. And I went, what? Oh, I'm just going to go for a walk. And I want to face my fear of actually seeing a live bear. There's no guarantee I would have, but, you know, whatever. And I had this amazing conversation, and he was telling about how his dad had died or was dying. And he just wanted to be at work because he didn't know how to deal with it. And it was just incredible. So anyway, he did get me some more logs, which was wonderful. And the next day I went off and I did my walk. And guess what? I'm walking in this park thinking I'm okay. I see bear scat, which is basically bear poo. I'm thinking, I'm fine. Okay, ring my... All you use in Canada is a bear bell and a whistle. That's what you use to track bears. So I'm walking along, see the bear poo everywhere, going, oh my, there's a bear here, there's a bear here. So I got my bell and I've got my whistle ready to blow it just in case I need to. And nothing. Fine. No problem whatsoever. I'm like, woohoo, I've faced my inner bear. I've done it. And I see this woman on the hill ahead of me and I'm like, oh, she's ahead of me. If anything happens, it'll happen to her first. So I'll be okay. I reach the crest of the hill. Boom, there's a bear. And I'm like, and of course, I was just so drawn to looking at this bear because it's so beautiful. And I was like, no, bear training. Never look a bear in the eye because that's challenging them. That's how we do as predators. Two eyes on the front. You look at each other, that means we're going to attack. I was like, no, no, no. Okay, just keep walking. Have your bear bell, ring it, la, 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 make noise. And I'm like, how did this happen? There was a woman ahead of me. She should have like warned me or whatever. Anyway, walk past it. I'm just panicking, thinking, am I going to hear the of the bear's paws coming in behind me? But amazingly, the bear, thankfully, was more interested in what it was doing than me. Got past it, met the woman. She's from Britain. She's living in Canada. And we had this amazing conversation. She said, I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know if I should stay in Canada or go back to the UK. And so we had an amazing conversation about that and about the fact that she got charged by the bear because she ran, because that's what you never do with a bear. You never, ever run. And it, of course, chased her. And I was like, well, you didn't stop or anything. But she did stop once she was safe. So I was like, oh, great. Thanks for saving my life. So anyway, we had an amazing conversation. And the end result was she stayed in Canada. I came back to the UK and I faced my inner bear, which was an amazing, amazing experience. And it was just beautiful. That bear was stunning to see it in the wild like that, that close. Not on purpose. You know, I wasn't a tourist in a car going, I'm going to take a picture of it and doing silly things like that. It was literally walking through a park and it couldn't have been a better experience. And that's my 10 minutes.
Great. Yes. Well, thank you. So what sort of bear was it? Was it a grizzly or?
No, it was a brown bear.
Yeah, they're apparently less.
They're less aggressive. Yeah.
Less aggressive. Yeah.
So I noted all of that. You note all of that when you're doing it, but you're still the heartbeat. It's just, you just don't know. Cause I don't know if it's got cubs, you know, the instant you get between a cub and a mama bear, that's, you're pretty much just curling a ball and hope for the best kind of situation. Because when you get them like that, it's bad luck basically.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I like the way that you prefigured the bear, because as soon as you mentioned facing the inner bear, I thought, I bet there's going to be an outer bear somewhere in this.
There definitely was. I faced both, basically. Yeah, which is great. It was a good experience to have.
Yeah,
I can't imagine like how that will be so scary.
Well, you know... I know my brothers faced a cougar, which to me, a cougar is even worse because if you see one cougar, that means there's another cougar probably behind you. Mm. And the way cats kill is they grab the back of your neck and snap it. So exactly. So it's kind of like, oh, what's behind me if this one's in front of me? So, yeah. Anyway, he survived that. That's fine. He's all right.
I mean, like, to be able to tell that story, you know, it's a good end.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I suspected that you got away.
Yeah, kind of. I'm here, and I don't have scars all over me. Thank goodness.
Bear wrestling. Well, it would be. It only happens in films, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and you can survive a bear brawl. But it's just how you deal with it. The thing is that this is the weird thing. You grow up in Canada learning these things. You literally you roll in a ball trying to protect your most vital organs, and you just try to pretend to be dead. So you don't make any noise. You try not to scream in agony, because anything that tells them that you're alive means they'll because what a bear normally does is they will kill its prey and bury it for later. So that's kind of what you're hoping, is that by holding yourself in that ball and trying to survive the attack, that it will stop before you die or get injured to the point that you can't remove yourself after it's gone. It's yeah. Now you know why I live in the UK. The worst thing here is a black adder.
Oh my God. That is, yeah, I'm like, oh, okay. Going to Canada is like, I don't
know. Well, it's not like that necessarily. Well, actually, no, I should say that. We have them in the cities too, but they're more on the outskirts, and they're usually more interested in the food than you. So that's the big thing about bears, is if most bears are more frightened of you than the other way around.
Right, okay. That's good to know. Yeah. I liked how you said about it being beautiful as well.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. I mean, that moment was just, for me, really magical. To this day, I still feel that, like, that was amazing to be that close to him, her, it, whatever.
Did seeing the bear actually help you with your decision? Well, with your inner bear, was that?
Yeah, absolutely. I just felt it was an amazing moment where I was, you know, had that talk with the gentleman the night before, saying, you know, you need to face your inner bear. And I was like, so that basically interpreted for me that I felt I had unfinished business in the UK. And I was like, if I stayed in Canada, that business wouldn't be finished. And so here I am till this day. That was a huge turning point, that I stayed here.
Yeah. So, still finishing that
business.
How
long have you been in the UK for?
I've been here over 20 years. So yeah, almost as long as I was in Canada. Mm. Oh, dare I say, telling my age there.
You look very young for your age.
Thank you.
Yes. Shall we move on?
Story.
Yes. Okay. I want to take you back to a weekend in... might have been 1960 or a year or two either side. On Saturdays, every weekend, in fact, on Saturdays, we'd go to see Nanan Sissons. And she lived with her youngest son, my Uncle Tony, in a house on Crooks Road in Sheffield. I still walk past that house today, and it looks in terrible repair, which is a little bit sad. Me and my sister, we both loved her. She was wonderful, and there were all sorts of reasons for that. And particularly, she was the proud owner of a pianola. So that was great fun to the nearest I've ever got to playing the piano and seeing the keys depress themselves as if by magic was great for a child. And she was a good cook. The thing that I remember, and I think we had it most Saturdays, if not every Saturday, was sausage meat sandwich. So you could buy, I don't know if you still can, but you could buy sausage meat without the skin of a sausage, turn it into a patty, fry it on either side. I can't remember if we had onions, but I think we had tomato ketchup and inside a bread cake. It's exactly the sort of thing kids would love. I think my vegetarianism would be severely challenged if I was presented by such a sandwich today. Partly nostalgia. One of the mysteries that I can't quite remember is for some reason, she prepared Sunday dinner on Saturday at lunchtime. And I to this day, I'm not quite sure why she did it then and who was with her, because Tony, Uncle Tony, came back in the evening. And when he came back, he made the most amazing sandwich I've ever encountered from the Sunday dinner. And my grandmother made Yorkshire puddings in big rectangular tins, and he would cut them into quarters, put a quarter down, put the meat on top of that, the potatoes, the vegetables. He had a big mouth, and then pickles. And he was really into pickles, not just pickled onions. There was mixed pickle, which you might have encountered, which is onions, cauliflower, and gherkins. Pickled red cabbage, pickled beetroot, piccalilli, all those sorts of things. And then another quarter of the Yorkshire pudding on top, and that was his sandwich. And we never got to taste that. But it was a spectacle to watch. And the story is that one day he went round a supermarket and he saw pickled peppers, and he thought, "Oh, I like pepper," and they were rather hot. So that was Nan and Sisson's. Sundays we went to see Nan and Lenton. We had a grandpa there as well, and she was very strict, so we're a little bit more wary of her. She wasn't unkind, but she was a bit severe. And that was partly to do, I think, with their history, because they were both in poverty from the early years of their marriage. But now they lived in a semi-detached house in a part of Sheffield called Cross Pool, which at the time was very sort of posh. And we had Sunday tea, and Sunday tea was a slice of ham, lettuce, cucumber, tomato, boiled egg, salad, celery in a flower vase. Well, you can imagine, as children, we weren't terribly thrilled by this. But there was dessert, because my grandmother was actually a very good cook. Sunday tea was perhaps a low point. I can remember her sausages, mashed potatoes, garden peas and gravy, which sounds very plain. And for my grandfather, the very first time she cooked for him after they were married, she made him a rice pudding. And that's pudding rice in a basin, milk on top, in the oven, a bit of nutmeg on top, perhaps, and it was baked long and slow. And when it came out, often the rice was a sort of pinkish colour. And he enjoyed that so much that she made it for him every day of their married life, until at some great age, they agreed that ambrosia tinned rice was just as good and went over to that. And she made wonderful things like tripe and onions. He had tripe and onions at least once a week, which was okay. We did taste that, but a bit, yeah. But the thing that I remember from Sunday tea that we did like was her custard tart. And the way she made this, pastry in those days was flour and water, lard rubbed into flour and water, and it was very sort of bland pastry, not really short crust. And that was, you lined a pie dish with that, greaseproof paper on top, and then she had a jar of beans that had been used as weights on the paper. And my mother had a similar jar, and that was such a distinctive smell of beans that had been baked and baked and baked over and over again. If I ever smelt that again, it would be really evocative of childhood. That would be put in the oven and it would be blind baked. And then the beans would be put back in the jar, the paper taken away, and then the custard, not your Birds Instant, but proper custard made with milk and eggs, poured in. Grated nutmeg, and it was always grated from a whole nutmeg in those days, and then into the oven, that was very much our favourite. And both grandparents, we felt quite differently about them, but I think it was through their food that they expressed not just their personalities, but their love for us and their daughter and or son and their grandchildren. So they're just good memories.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
Sounds yummy.
I know. My mouth was watering on like different foods I could taste. Like, because when someone describes food, it's like it's almost as if you're eating it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love the, because you're reminding me of that much more the time people took over food. Because nowadays it's like, how fast can I get it and eat it? But that, you know, that family meal thing is so lovely. And, you know, to know that there's, you know, they all have their specialties that they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
That take like half a day or a day to make or a day before, you know, we just don't tend to do that so much these days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was part of the routine as well, you know, every week. And I forgot to mention my Nan and Sisson, she actually had I think they called it a kitchen range, which basically there was an open fire in the room, and there was like an oven over the fire, so she could put the kettle on the top and so on. So everything was the Sunday lunch cooked on a Saturday was kept in there until Tony came home.
Yeah. Oh, I love those days. You know, when everything was kind of it's a little more real and less artificial.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And And I get the impression my grandfather was a buyer for a chain of greengrocers, and I've got a photograph of one of those greengrocer shops. It was actually on Crooks. Gemma will know the place. But the food, the vegetables look really good.
Mm.
I think he was going out and he was buying the best from the wholesale markets.
I know what you mean about those peas, because you said, it was a plain meal. But peas that are grown from a garden, because my grandmother she had a market stall in London, Ontario, and she grew stuff for the stall. Mm. And you could pick the peas off of the pods and then you would eat them. And they just don't taste like a canned pea or something you get in a supermarket today. Yeah. Even to this day, I could still get that. Mm. Oh, that kind of pea is different than what we get now.
Well, they didn't grow them as a summer. Grandfather was a buyer, so she would have got. I mean, the thing is, The shop assistants knew my grandmother and they knew my mother, because as I say, there were several shops, so we always got a good deal.
Nice.
Okay, Gemma, how about you? What have you got to tell us?
So this was a few years ago, and I was looking for a job. And I walked past, so in Sheffield, there's a cathedral in the centre of Sheffield. And I had in my mind quite strongly as I was walking in the centre of town and past this cathedral. And I was looking at all the shops going past and kind of intuiting whether I might be able to work there or not. Even though I didn't particularly want to work in a shop. I just felt like I need some money and I need a job and I need to do something. Even though I had a job being self-employed, I just thought, right, okay, let's just get a job somewhere. And then I see this restaurant and I can't see on the window anything yet. But I look at it and I almost like sear my eyes into the... the window, and I say, this place is going to have a job for me. And I walk up to the window and I see that they do have some offerings, but it's kind of supervisor roles and it's not really something that I'm qualified in or trained in. So anyways, I go in and I just think, what the hell, I'll just say hi and say, look, I'm looking for a job. And I start to talk about you know, hi, I'm looking for a job. And they say, well, you're not really qualified for this position, but we really like your energy. What do you do? And I'm like, well, I'm a singer and I do voice workshop, you know, I do things that, I don't think I hadn't started my voice workshops at this time, but I was a singing teacher and I'd done a lot of dance teaching and I was training to be a life coach. So I told them all this and they said, well, upstairs we have a room that you can use for workshops. So I went upstairs and there was all these like art on the wall and it was like a really nicely done out kind of room, quite spacious as well. And so I thought, yeah, this is good. I can definitely, you know, use this. And I kind of visualized like how the workshops might go. And then they said, yeah, and you can do gigs downstairs as well. So you can put on a gig here as well. So I thought, this is great. And basically in exchange for the room, they said, you can help us out in the kitchen and do some waitressing. And then we will offer you the room for the workshops and we'll cook for the participants. So basically, I started working and I was I was mostly doing waitressing, but there would always be really interesting people coming in. So if you're from Sheffield, it's Blend Kitchen, the place which used to be across from the cathedral, but it's not anymore, they've moved. But all the people that would come in would just be like artsy people or kind of I don't know, Green Party, like people that were into kind of things that I was interested in. And I would talk to everybody and I would just tell them, you know, I'm doing a gig on this day, come along. And I met this woman and her son from America, and they were really interested in that. They were saying, and he had a t-shirt on that said "Stick It to the Man," and I was like, oh, that's from Rock School of Rock musical. You might be interested in the gig. So come along if you like music. Come along to my gig. And I didn't expect them to come, but they did, because they were just staying in Sheffield for a little time, and they decided to come along to the gig, and they actually really liked one of my songs. She commented, which is Afraid of Love, which is actually going to be my single that's coming out really soon. And if you're listening to this podcast, it may already be out already, so you can go stream it on Spotify and iTunes. So basically, I ended up doing not only just a bit of waitressing, but I also made French toast and I made pizzas, mini pizzas for the kids. Only a little bit. I wasn't like a super cook in the restaurant. But what it did is it actually gave me the realization that cooking is so creative. And it matched my passion for creativity in the sense of like that I do performing arts. But then I realized like, oh, this is another avenue for my creativity. And so then at home, I started to make more interesting foods. I would do soups and put in, some different ingredients, vegetables that I might not have used before. I would try out different things. And it just gave me a little bit of passion for that. And also the other thing is that when we were doing the group sessions, we would do the workshops and we'd be doing the singing and sounding, and then we would come downstairs and they would have food out for us. And it was just a really nice community of food and singing. And then, you know, some people that came to the workshops as well were singers themselves or artists themselves. There was a lady that was writing a play as well. So afterwards, the party wouldn't stop. It was like we would go on to a gig of someone that was in the group, or we would go on to an open mic, or we would go to a reading of the play that, you know, one of the people that was in the group was in. So I felt like, you know, really, really special in the sense of what was being created. Not that I don't mean in me I felt special, as in it was special what was being born, because even though I kind of, you know, had the idea or started it, it was almost as if, you know, it was bringing things that I hadn't even thought of, you know, to go and support, you know, someone doing their artwork of what they were bringing. So I think, and also using the, you know, the food to connect as well. So I think it was really special to be able to be a part of that. So that's my little story. I still do Finding Your Voice workshops. There's going to be one in December on the 17th. I don't know if the podcast will be out by then, but you can also have one-on-ones with me as well. And I will have other workshops and things in the new year as well. So yes, that's my little story.
Yeah, I think the a theme underlying actually probably all three of the stories, I'm thinking of the logs in Debbie's story, there's that underlying theme of hospitality. And you know, the archetypal sitting around the fire, sharing food. I suspect, I've been reading the history of cheese in the British Isles. I suspect a lot of the food that was shared would actually be cheese. We sort of imagine people with great big haunches of meat and so on, and meat was less common for a lot of people. But sharing stories and sharing music, it's all part of the same sort of activity. And conversation, of course, yes. And indeed sharing logs for the fire or whatever.
Well, yeah, I mean, we, and I have so many great memories, you know, at that cabin that we got, we would sit out around the fire and have meals, because we would cook the meal on the fire and we would be there for hours looking at the stars. My dad would regale us with these ridiculous stories. And yeah, it was just magical. And I love the fact that you used your intuition to draw you to the place, and then it just blossomed into this incredible self-discovery and helping other people. And now look at you, now you're still on that journey of what that one decision to go, I'm just going to get this job and I'm going to go over there. And I think that's just, wow, more people, hats off, need to do that, including me.
Yeah. Definitely. I do think intuition, I mean, we talked about this in the last podcast we did with Sharon Sammy. We talked about manifesting, but also using your intuition to draw you to the right people and the right places. And a conversation that me and Chris had as well after was around how I really liked how Chris was describing how it's almost like you need to be in dialogue with the universe. So a lot of the times we just kind of expect the universe to kind of hand it on a plate, but sometimes it's almost like it's putting the, you know, the intention out there. But then once you're there, it's almost like you need to engage with the people around you and the places around you. So it's that community kind of thing. And I think that's what I did in that instance, was because, you know, instead of just going in there and sort of, and what they did as well, because you could have had a situation where I just went in there and I said, you know, I'm looking for a job, and they might have gone, you know what, actually, we, you know, you're not qualified for this job, and no, there's nothing here. But instead, you know, I was able to bring an energy which said, you know, I have something to offer here, and I can be of benefit to your business, and I can bring music and community and voice and conversation and joy. And then they picked up on that, and they said, well, we can offer you something as well, you know, we can bring you food and help your business and people. And do you know what I mean? So it's kind of like when we think of using our intuition. It's also about what we bring. Once we are drawn to certain people or places, because if we don't bring our full self, or if we don't share what we have to offer, then it's almost like we can miss out on opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree completely with what you said. Very nice.
Yes. Okay, so where can we find you if anyone wants to find out more about your voice work, which you've not spoken a lot about? I don't know if you want to share a little bit.
Okay, yeah, I didn't say much about it. Well, I'm on my website, which is really easy. My name is one of the easiest names in the English language, if you're English speaking, to remember. If you're not, it might be more awkward. But it's www.debbie, D-E-B-B-I-E, bridge as in over water, B-R-I-D-G-E.com. And on there, you'll find all the access to my YouTube, my Facebook, all of it's there. But I think YouTube, I'm under Debbie Bridge. Instagram, I'm Debbie Bridge 1. And Twitter, I'm Debbie Bridge. And LinkedIn, I'm Debbie Ann Bridge, A-N-N, for some reason. I had to, you know, Debbie Bridge had already gotten in there before me because we're so common. voiceover. I didn't say much about that. The thing is, like I said to you, as a kid, I grew up with a dad who was definitely a storyteller and didn't mind being a complete fool. And so I grew up with this kind of weird, crazy ideas and stuff. And the thing is, when you grow up in such a natural environment like Canada is, imagination is a huge part of it for two reasons, because you got to drive long distances. And when you're a kid sitting in the back of the car, imagination is the only thing you've got to entertain you, because after a while, the toys in the backseat are just boring. So you go into your mind and they have all these ideas. And I had a really good friend in school, and we used to make up a fake language. We just would like create weird sounds. And I've always had that ever since then. I talk in weird sounds to my animals, to the people closest to me. I'll just be like, and they all have kind of meaning. And so making strange sounds has always been a part of it. And when I found out in high school that I had a talent, like I had a natural talent, that I was like, really? I have a talent? I didn't know that. I was really excited about it. And I love to mimic commercials. So I would always hear commercials. My problem is I know like one line of thing, you know, if they play the song of something in a commercial, that's the line I'll know. And I'll copy that. And I use that all the time. So when I do productions, it's the same thing. I'll have these catchphrases. So it's been like a natural, I was born to do voiceover without knowing that I had this natural tendency. And the thing with voiceover these days is they're wanting more and more of an actor anyway. And of course, the versatility is useful, to be able to not be afraid to make sounds and sound weird and look weird, because you're in a booth and it's soundproof and there's a glass window with a bunch of people on the other side who you can't always hear what they're saying. You just see their faces and it's not always looking good. And it's just trying to get past all of that and do the best you can and ask the best questions you can to try and hopefully the client will be satisfied with the end product, which I have never had a complaint, thank goodness, today, and I don't ever want one. But it's a weird environment. You don't have anything else to bounce off of. There's no set, no stage, no costume, no other actor. Sometimes there's no other actor. Sometimes there can be actors in the room and you can play with them. Yeah. And you're restricted because you're stuck with a mic. So there can be a restrictive movement. So there's all of that's a part of what you learn as a VO, to try and make sure that you bring across a very naturalistic and genuine creation of any script, whether it's corporate, whether it's a narrative, whatever book, you're looking to create something that people will want to listen to and engage with and feel not put away, pushed away. And the thing is, sound is so important. And this is something I've learned over the years. Of all the mediums of what we get, there's visual, sound, touch, whatever. Sound is the biggest. If you go to a movie and you watch it and you're like, oh, that was amazing, but there's some problems with lighting, whatever. If the sound is bad, the whole thing is bad. Nobody forgives you for bad sound. Yeah. They forgive you for bad visuals and bad acting and bad storyline, but they will not forgive you for bad sound. That's where it's just like, I can't watch this film. It's so annoying to hear. I've got to leave, or this recording or whatever. So it's so, that just tells me how important we speak. And it's funny, when I was first singing, and everybody tends to go through this period in their teens and even till being adults, they listen to their real voice and they go, I hate my voice. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's just, you might as well just said you hate yourself, because our voice tells everything about us. There's something, you know, and when we hear the actual voice that people hear, because of course the one in our head is not the one that comes outside, it's not familiar. And it's only that unfamiliarity of who you really are. It's the more you get in marriage with your own sound and your own voice, I think you get more in marriage and acceptance of who you are as a person. And loving that sound is a good thing, not a bad thing. So you know that phrase, oh, they love the sound of their voice. I do.
Yes.
That's kind of a negative connotation, but that's just somebody going on too much about something.
Yeah.
Rather than, it's great to love your voice, because it's just like, you should love yourself. You know, this is the gift that you've been given. Don't say I have ugly hands or whatever, because this is who you are. You're the beautiful creature that you are.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I do in my coaching, is I'll get people to do affirmations around their voice. Like, I love my voice. You know, I enjoy expressing myself, you know, things like that, because it does start within, with accepting one, who you are, and then being able to express it on the outside. I think one of the reasons why a lot of people maybe don't like their voice is because perhaps they're not expressing themselves in the way that they want to. And so if that's happening, if they're not, you know, speaking from the truth of who they are, then they're going to hear something that's not actually who, it's not reflective of their full self, if that makes sense. I don't know if you agree
definitely
with that, but
absolutely when I've been teaching and everything, you know, or even in my own personal experience. And now I completely love the voice. It's really weird now when I hear my voice, say accidentally, you know, somebody plays a recording and I'm like, oh, that's a nice voice. Whose is that? Oh, wait a second. That's me. Well, that's good that I have that reaction. And it's not like, ooh, oh, that's a terrible sound.
Yeah. I love how, like, sometimes I won't even know the difference between whether it's somebody else or myself. So sometimes my parents often will say, is that you? When they hear like a singer on TV, like if I'm just playing some music, they won't know if it's me or a singer. And I think that's a really cool kind of thing to
commercial
just,
sound.
Yeah, just to have that kind of confidence in your own voice and to know that, yeah, I sound good and I like how I sound and I appreciate my voice, because it's an expression of who I am.
I think that's also why a lot of actors end up doing call center jobs, is because they bring the sound is great. They bring a genuine sound to when you're talking on the phone. They're great salespeople because of that, because they just have a really engaging. The amount of times I've flirted on phones with various salespeople, it's hilarious because of the sound. They don't know what I look like. It's just, it's great. It's fun. It's lots of fun. It's like,
it's fun, isn't it? And I think having that agility with your voice as well, and being able to express yourself in so many different ways, it's just a lot of fun. And that's why I just kind of, it amazes me that not everyone does this work, because I think if everyone did it, like if it was a subject at school, for example, like voice class, like you would have in drama school, you know, I think everybody should have it. And then, you know, we'd all be loving each other's voices and then just basking in this joy of like, wow, yeah, we can express ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you completely. Whenever I always feel sad when somebody says, I hate the sound of my voice. I'm like, oh.
It's so sad. Yeah. And it's so common. So common.
Yeah.
Almost everyone. Unless they're someone that, Even singers.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes I will watch, you know, famous singers and they're watching themselves back. You know, they do these videos where they watch themselves and they comment on it. And, you know, I saw one the other day and it was, she's a beautiful singer. She's an amazing singer, famous. And then, you know, she's watching it and she's going, oh, ooh, no. And I'm like, What? Why are you criticizing it? Like, you know, even if it wasn't quite on pitch on one bit, you could just say it in a different way. Oh, that wasn't quite on pitch. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah,
Rather than, you know, this kind of like, oh, get it away from me, stop the sound kind of thing.
Yeah, I think judging or critiquing are very two different things. Critiquing is what you're talking about. Judging is where we take it all on very personally.
Exactly, yeah.
Well,
I mean, I'm not saying I don't do that sometimes, you know, but I try not to.
Yeah. I'm just glad Gemma's not with me when I edit the podcast. I'm going, every time I hear myself.
Yeah, I've told you this, Chris.
I was going to ask, Chris, do you like the sound of your voice?
Well, I'm getting more used to it. I've had a little bit of coaching from somebody.
We've done quite a bit of work on like you getting to just be more free flowing with your expression as well.
And I think also when you hear other people speak, often I find myself thinking he needs. Some time with Gemma, not because there's something inherently bad about the voice, but they just need to. I mean, for example, yesterday I was at a business network meeting in a huge room, and there were lots of problems with projection there.
Oh yeah,
that
one comes up a lot.
Well, yes, and learning how to project is
quite a simple thing to shift as well.
It's not too difficult. I mean, the last session I went to about voice projection was I'm a Methodist local preacher, and he was a preacher in his 90s, and he had this suitcase with him, and he blew the dust off it. He said, "I've not opened this for about 20 years," and he clicked it, opened it up, and it was a ventriloquist dummy. And none of us knew, had any idea that he'd been a ventriloquist in his younger year. Well, you know, up to about 70. And but ventriloquists can project the, you know, they had the mouth almost closed, and it sounds like they're on the back row in a big room. They're brilliant at projection. And we just couldn't believe what he was able to do with his voice. He said the way to do it is put your forefinger and middle finger together, and that's how wide you need to open your mouth to project. You don't have to shout. If you open your mouth that much, then you can project. And he said the only exception to that is ventriloquists. So he didn't actually tell us how to do it.
Yeah, it's true. You don't use it. That's also one of those fallacies that you open your mouth wide. I mean, that's what it sounds like. It doesn't. It sounds distorted and strange.
Well, it doesn't
so
have to be
why
that
would
wide,
you do that? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I suppose I do get people to open their mouth wide only because sometimes what happens is the mouth is so small that the sound's not even coming out. So it's almost like making it that stretch sound.
Yeah.
But you would never do it like that, obviously, on stage. You won't be like, oh.
Unless you do it, like I said, unless you're doing a strange character that you wanted to be like that. Because that does happen. But it's good to know that, you, like you said, know the extremes of what your voice can do. Is also useful, especially in the work I do, is how far can I push this without doing damage? Because you can easily damage. These are all very delicate muscles and a tissue in the vocal apparatus. So you have to look after it, which is one of the things I always like to talk about, but nobody does like to talk about it, which is vocal health. How do you stay healthy as a performer or whatever you do?
Yeah.
You know,
tips,
yes. Drink lots of water, sleep well, and when you feel that something isn't right, it's a warning. Yeah, it's a warning. So if you get a tickle, an itch, a scratch in that vocal apparatus, that means something's not right. So don't push it beyond that and just sort that out.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So
where were we?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Food! Where's food in this? Yes. Eat well.
We're almost.
Well, you can sing for your supper.
Yep. And I do too, actually. Yes. I have in the past and even today.
Yes. Should we do a little Christmas like song to finish?
Come on, Chris.
Chris is going to do one. Woo.
Woo.
We're
going to sing a Christmas carol. Which one?
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, let's see. How about Wild Shepherds Watch to the tune of Ilkley Mo Bartat? Can you manage
that?
I was going to say, that's really hard. I don't know that one.
You need one that we all know like that.
Wish You a Merry Christmas is probably easier.
What do you know then?
We Wish You a Merry Christmas, maybe. Do we know that one?
Yes, I
was like, the words are pretty much the same on every line. So
do you need to, before we do it though, Chris, do you want to say just quickly how people can find you and what you've got going on?
Yes.
Most of mine.
I offer marketing coaching with stories to businesses in turbulent times, and basically all businesses are in turbulent times at the moment. We're still in the middle of a pandemic, apparently heading straight for another great storm of an exciting new virus, climate change, of course, a lot of adverse stuff going on in the economy. But often we don't really know our business as well as we should. It's a bit like not knowing your voice, because you, in a way, your business is a part, is like your voice. It's a way that you project yourself. But to find out about your business as well as to market it, stories are incredibly powerful. Once you start to dig into a story and look at how it might be used to support your business, you find all sorts of things and insights that you didn't even imagine was going on in your business, which is why you should talk to me if you really want to have a go and come up with marketing that actually markets your business and doesn't just keep the search engines going. That's me. How about you, Gemma?
Yeah, so I think I've mentioned a few different things, but basically you can find me on creativehearts.coach on Facebook and Instagram, YouTube, and then I'm Gemma Rosenthal on LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook and Instagram as well. So I have the music side of my business and you know, dance and acting things, and then I also have the coaching side. So yes, you can have creative coaching with me, or you can watch my music and listen and yeah, things like that. So what was I going to say?
That's it. You're going to sing a song.
Christmas carol.
Are you going to give us a note?
Is that right?
No idea.
We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Glad tidings we bring
to you and your kin.
We wish you a Merry Christmas
and a Happy New Year.
I think it was hard to get it in time. It was difficult.
Yeah, it's the time lag of sound. That's one of the things I've learned. Sound doesn't travel like visual.
It's typical on Zoom. You know, you can't sing together. I've had to lead services on Zoom, and it's impossible to sing together.
No.
Best just to turn the sound off and just sing along on your own.
It's a new technology they're trying to create, is to create real sound in the same time as visuals.
I think that would be really helpful, especially for my voice workshops.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, farewell. Thank you very much, Debbie. That's been great.
Thank you.
We'll come to an end. Goodbye.
Thank you.